The Steady State Sentinels, produced by The Steady State, a community of former national security professionals who spent their careers safeguarding the United States at home and abroad.
Today, we continue that mission by staying true to our oaths to defend the Constitution,
uphold our democracy, and protect our nation's security. Join our expert hosts as they interview field-tested guests whose unique experiences shed light on the crises and challenges facing our nation. All right, you're listening to the Steady State Sentinel. I'm John Cipher, along with my former CIA colleague, Jim Lawler, both former officers in CIA's clandestine service. Today's guest is someone who's been at the center of the biggest political storms of the last few years and decided to stand his ground anyway. Adam Kinzinger is a former U.S. congressman from Illinois, a longtime member of the Air National Guard, and one of the most prominent Republican critics of Donald Trump. He served on the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol, a decision that put him at odds with much of his own party and ultimately cost him his seat in Congress. And he's the subject of a recent Amazon documentary called The Last Republican. Since leaving office, Adam's become a leading voice on courage in politics, the future of American democracy, and what it means to put country over party. He's also been unusually honest about the personal cost of all that, the threats, the isolation, and the backlash, even from people he once considered friends and allies. Whether you agree with his politics or not, Adam's story raises big questions about integrity, fear, and what we're willing to risk for what we believe. So with that, let's just jump in. Adam Kinzinger, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, listen, but if you don't agree with my policies, you're wrong. You should have added that. No, it's good to be with you guys. Look, and I want to apologize. I'm not sure if you guys use the video or just audio, but regardless, audio. I'm going to sound, okay, I will sound to everybody sick because I am. So I want to just... on the front end, apologize, but we'll be good. We're going to make it through this. So thanks
for having
me.
I know you want to sound muscular and masculine. So yeah, maybe we can fix that. But just to start real quick, you served in the Air Force and in Congress. And I'm really interested in how your sense of duty developed. Like basically, I'm asking, how does one cultivate the quote unquote character muscle that's needed to say country first when the party says otherwise? Is there anything from your experience building blocks?
It's a great question, and it's probably something that, you know, most of your folks that worked with you can share and understand, right? It's like, it's a couple things. Like, I've never understood people that, you know, do a job, whether it's military, whether it's intelligence, whether it's politics, you know, that is so impactful on so many people's lives, and they don't care about what their role in history is or the bigger cause. It just becomes like, it's about my career or whatever. And so for me, it was a combination, a little bit of how I was raised. You know, obviously, you got to have parents that instill something like that in you. But really, so I had come back from Iraq in 2009, and basically announced I was running for Congress right then. And I remember thinking, you know, look, if I am going to run for a job that is going to, you know, I'm going to pass budgets, I'm going to probably vote for people to go to war, you know, these different things. Like, if I'm going to put people's lives in the line, I have to be willing to give my career for the country, right? Like, a 19-year-old who goes and dies on behalf of the United States of America, as terrible as it is, we need people willing to do that. And if I'm going to ask people to do that but not be willing to give up a $174,000 a year job, I don't have a right to it. And so the interesting thing is, like, throughout my whole time running, and then even when I was elected, I would talk about that. And then that moment happened. I thought it would be like, you know, voting to fix Social Security or something that would kill me. I didn't think it would be, you know, January 6th, but that's what happened. And I really honestly, when, you know, the president claimed that night of the election, he's like, they're stealing the election, the whole intervening time. I saw no other option. I didn't see any other possibility but to just do what I ended up doing. And frankly, 99% of my colleagues should have said the same thing.
Adam, I've got a question. Do you think there's still room in the Republican Party for moderates or centrists? Prior to the 2016 election, I was a moderate Republican. And now, like a reformed smoker who hates smoking, I've become a relatively strident anti-Trump activist. I feel like the Republican Party personally has lost its soul and betrayed me. But I'd love to hear your views on this.
I fully agree with you. I don't think there is room. I think, in fact, if you're a conservative, so if you're listening and you consider yourself a conservative, like an actual conservative governing philosophy, you shouldn't be a Republican because there's nothing conservative about the Republican Party. It's illiberal, right? Conservatism used to believe in, you know, a small government, but an important role for government, you know, strong national defense. This guy is the opposite of that. And he's convinced an entire party that basically their biggest allegiance is not to the Constitution, it's to him. And so, no, Jim, I don't think that there's any space for anybody like you or I in the party right now. And I think this goes to my Democratic friends, and it's kind of the message I'm out there preaching, which is like, look, I would love in a perfect world to be able to have like a centrist third party. It's not going to happen. So where does that leave people that feel politically homeless, which now is a significant amount of the country? It's the Democratic Party. And so the Democrats have got to be willing to have disagreements in the tent, but at least you're in power. Because when you're not in power, you lose everything. When you're in power, you can have those battles. Now, I hope in 10 years, when Donald Trump is out and this kind of cancer goes through the GOP, that there will be a space again. But I'm not going to sit and hold my breath till that happens. They have, in my mind, the Republican Party has lost their right to govern.
Your documentary, which I watched recently and thought was excellent, The Last Republican.
Thank you.
It offers a lot of the behind-the-scenes view of your final year in Congress and your role with the January 6th committee and the personal cost of your taking a different path than a lot of your Republican colleagues. So what motivated you to open your life and do that documentary, that kind of scrutiny?
That's a great question because I didn't want to do it. But it's funny because I actually didn't even want to be on the committee. So, you know, I voted to impeach Trump and then I voted to form the committee. So there were 10 of us that voted to impeach, and then just Liz and I were the ones that voted for the committee, which was disappointing, but, you know, we did. And, you know, they ended up putting Liz on the committee, and I remember thinking, good, like, because, you know, Pelosi is going to put a Republican on there. Thank God it's Liz. Now I can live my life. And you know, I end up getting put on it, obviously. And so we had all these different documentaries that would come and kind of talk to documentarians that would come and talk to me and be like, hey, we want to follow you. We want to, you know, we want to dial, we want to figure out what's going on here. But a lot of it was focused on, we're interested in the horse race. Can a guy who's anti-Trump win in a primary against Trump, you know, and it was all that kind of stuff. And I knew at the time that I probably wasn't going to run again. I mean, I had been in Congress 12 years, which I think is long enough anyway, but I finally talked to Steve Pink, who was the director of Hot Tub Time Machine, one of my favorite movies. He also did Gross Point Blank, High Fidelity, like a lot of ones you've heard of. And then Kevin Morris was the financier. They basically talked to me, and I knew Kevin from a prior life. And he's like, look, we're actually interested in the human element, not the horse race. And so I talked with my wife, and we finally agreed to do it because we're like, two things. Number one, I think it's important for people to see the human toll, the human impact that I knew was coming. I mean, obviously, I hadn't even lived it yet. But second is, you know, we're in the middle of having a child. And it's like, how are we ever going to explain this time to him? And we figured this is the best way to do it. And so he's 4 now, and he's old enough and cognizant. Someday he'll watch this movie and kind of get an idea of what he went through as a baby. And so that's kind of what I think, you know, what motivated us to do it. It was a tough decision.
And Steve's a big liberal, right? So how is that working with him?
Oh, yeah, he is. So it's funny because the movie ends up being basically, it tells the story of January 6th a little bit. It's the human element. And then it's also this like tug and pull between him and I. Like I'm kind of the conservative. He's the liberal. And we end up, you know, we're friends, right? And so that's kind of an important lesson. But yeah, they filmed this and they were editing it and they realized that we had this like banter back and forth between us. And they're like, this is a great, perfect way to kind of lay out the film. And so it's funny. I actually would say he learned a ton through doing this because he's like, I learned that a conservative or at least a centrist, I can get along with him. So I have changed his life for the better, I'm proud to say.
For you.
Adam, I'm interested in whether you can identify any current Republican political candidates or office holders who share your moral courage and values, your conservative values. I mean, do you see any on the horizon or in place now?
No. If you'd ask me, you know, I'd say between, you know, 17 and maybe 21 or 22, I probably could have found a few Republicans that are standing tall, right? You think of like Brad Raffensperger, I guess I'll say Brad Raffensperger is actually an example. You know, the Secretary of State of Georgia stood up against Trump, still got reelected, running for governor now. He's actually running against another friend of mine who I'm very supportive of, Jeff Duncan, who was the lieutenant governor Republican, now running as a Democrat for the same reason we discussed. He just recognizes there's no home in the GOP. But no, I wish I could say here's a huge litany of people that represent the kind of values we need, but they've all been drummed out. I mean, they've either decided not to run again. They've lost their primary. You know, Donald Trump has been in our life for 10 years, 10 years. And you cannot survive, you know, this cult that demands 100% loyalty for 10 years with your morals intact. And you guys know this as intel people, which is like, you understand better than I do, or maybe as good as politicians do, because we have an innate understanding of people. You understand that people can convince themselves that anything they do is right. Right? I mean, why is it in 1936 you wouldn't have recruited anybody in Nazi Germany to guard a tower at Auschwitz? But by the 40s, you could do it because you make little, and I'm not comparing them to Nazis here, but it's like you make little like compromises in your soul. And you, the human condition, can convince yourself that whatever you're doing is right. I mean, Al-Qaeda believes they're the holy warriors, right? They believe what they're doing is right. And so, yeah, after 10 years, these folks have convinced themselves, even against all evidence, that, yeah, Donald Trump may be a little uncouth, but he's a good dude, and he's fighting the evil people in Hollywood or whatever, you know, and that's where we're at.
It's sort of like an organized crime boss, too, that makes you complicit, makes you say something, yeah. It's illegal or wrong, and then you're bought, and they own you, right?
So, yep, 100%.
Here, I have a question. So you were on the committee, and you uncovered volumes of documents, interviews, debates. I thought it was really, obviously, well done. So here's my question. What juicy stuff did you leave out? What other stuff do you have on Trump and January 6th that you didn't bring up in the committee?
I wish there was a bunch of cool stuff. A lot of it is in the report, so it may not have come up in the hearings. You know, one of the things that I think is interesting is, like, the financing side of this. So we didn't, unfortunately, get enough attention to it because we kind of had to limit what we could do. But one of the things you see is how you guys, again, understanding radicalization, how the fundraising emails between the night of the election and January 6th radicalized about 30% of the GOP. So you imagine it, like, every day, if you're on the, you know, the donor list where you get the emails, you get 10 emails every day that say something along the lines of, they're stealing the election. Nancy Pelosi is this, so-and-so is that. And eventually that radicalized so many people. So that was like stuff that I wish we'd have been able to talk more about, is just like how the fundraising stuff, how the money situation is so corrosive and radicalizing. But I also think this, which is, we did a lot of work. We uncovered a lot of stuff, but quite honestly, where we ended should have been where the DOJ was when we started. Right. Instead, what we saw, and I have a lot of bitterness about this, what we saw is we did our first hearing a year after, that first in the series, so a year after the committee was formed, we have our first major hearing. And only then did the DOJ go, oh my goodness, there's a lot of information here. We better go after Donald Trump. And then they appointed Jack Smith. To his credit, he did the best he could, but he was up against the clock. And so I have a lot of anger against Merrick Garland, because he should have, on the day he became attorney general, should have put a, you know, special counsel in charge. And instead he waited for us, who, by the way, we didn't have near the tools that DOJ has to get confessions or to get testimony. And yet we were able to uncover enough that I think it would have been prosecutable in court. And they started a year behind. So that bothers me.
And also Congress should have, with the impeachment, should have convicted, right? So there's a political and a legal problem to this.
Cowardice on both sides. And Mitch McConnell, who is now trying to write his view in history or whatever, he owns this, and Kevin McCarthy, more than Donald Trump owns his resurrection. Kevin McCarthy and Mitch McConnell. And so I guess there's three people I'm pretty angry at. Those are them.
Well, it's no surprise that suddenly people who are out of office grow a backbone and start to show some courage. But other than the Civil War, Adam, do you see any parallels in our history to what the country is currently going through?
You know, I would say maybe the 30s, the 20s and 30s, because you came off of a pandemic, right? You came out of a war, World War I, and obviously the War on Terror was not near as violent or bloody as World War I, but you could argue that since that was in our face every day because of new media, maybe it had the same psychological impact. You know, the Ku Klux Klan, for God's sakes, you know, the state over from mine in Illinois, the Ku Klux Klan was like, had a million members. They were marching all over Washington, D.C. It's interesting. I had in my district in Princeton, Illinois, there's this old theater and they were revitalizing it. And they showed me this ticket they found somewhere, wherever they were revitalizing it, that was a admit one to the Ku Klux Klan rally in Princeton, Illinois. And so you think of that, you know, look, there were Madison Square Garden, the Nazi movement. So it feels like maybe that a little bit. Obviously, there are not perfect parallels, but where I get, you know, both hopeful and concerned, the hopeful side is, look, they always say like history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes, right? So nothing, you know, we come out of every difficult period and win. But I look at that period and say the thing that really pulled us out of that was a world war. And I don't see, you know, right or wrong, I don't see a world war on the horizon. Are we going to get out of this self-dividing moment? And I hope that we get to a point where maybe people are just sick of the division enough. I mean, I saw earlier, you know, Donald Trump's post about the murder of Rob Reiner, where he's like, this guy had TDS, you know, Trump derangement syndrome, Rob Reiner. Like, what kind of horrible human being are you to think of that? And I've got to imagine that at some point, like, kind of our psyche says that's wrong, but I don't know.
Well, you could also cite the way he treated John McCain. Yeah. I mean, just.
And that was so, just the beginning of his career. That's when it rocketed. Incredible.
It is incredible. And you wonder if, yeah, it swings too far and it'll swing back. We can only hope. So just to go back to your film, like, have you received much feedback from people either inside the government, military, politicians, national security about how the film resonates with the values of professionalism and service? Because we still need professionals and serious people in government, if not in politics.
Look, I've heard nothing but good stuff. Now, I will say, and it has very good Rotten Tomato scores, so I'll say that objectively. but I'll also say that nobody's going to call me and say, your movie sucked, right? Your the documentary about you was boring, and I
would have said it. I would have said it.
Yeah, you would have, because you know, you're a Hollywood guy, right? But no, everybody's been very positive. And, you know, again, what I think is good about it, and I just say this, you know, obviously recognizing I'm the guy in it, is like, I try to be very real and show people the human toll. You know, look, we think back, and I'm not comparing myself to him, but I've had in my mind lately, particularly with the Vladimir Putin situation, Winston Churchill. And, you know, Churchill, you realize, like, we read books about him and he's this amazing hero, right? Guy that drank and smoked cigars and he was awesome and he knew. But like a good portion of his life, he was the dude on the outside. He was called a warmonger. I've been called a warmonger a lot. You know, but it was a moment when he came in. But I say all that to say, like, history is not made by people that do the popular thing. They're made by the people that feel isolated and alone. And I'm not, again, in no way am I comparing myself to him. But what I'm seeing, though, is that when you have to make a tough decision and stand alone, I think the vast majority of people get some version of a chance to do that in their life. Not necessarily in Congress, but wherever, whatever their job is. And very few people do it because it's hard. And that's what I think where we've fallen short of showing people, and I hope that maybe this film does that, is like, especially to young people, you will have an opportunity in your life to do the right thing, but it's not going to be the obvious decision. Because if it was the obvious decision, you'd never stand out because everybody would do it. And so, yeah, I've gotten some good pushback, good feedback, and all my military guys like it. Although, as you know, if you're in a military squadron, they give you crap about everything. So I have gotten that.
Well, speaking of Vladimir Putin and you're being a military veteran, I'd just be very interested in what your views are on the current situation vis-a-vis Russia and its invasion of Ukraine. Traditionally, the Republican Party has been very much concerned about the Russian threat, and that seems to be evaporating like steam.
Yeah, it really does. And, you know, the weird thing is I still see polls that show 70% of Americans or of Republicans, for instance, support Ukraine over Russia. And that's good. I mean, good, I guess, you know, but it's like, I think we're a Republican that will pretend like, you know, they're sort of still with Ukraine, will say like, oh, well, we just shouldn't give all this money to Ukraine. Like, yeah, I want Ukraine to win, but we've got to take care of the boys here at home, you know, that kind of stuff. And let me just say where I think the Biden administration fell short is in messaging. I mean, when I tell people that the vast majority of aid to Ukraine is spent on American products, or, you know, simply it's just a value put to old equipment that was going to time out anyway. I mean, half of the ATACMs we sent Ukraine probably would have been destroyed by now and controlled detonations. Instead, we gave it to them and put a value on it. But they didn't do a good job of explaining that. So it seemed like we're writing a $100 billion check, then it's going to this black hole of nothingness. Look, I think we cannot forget the fact that, and I mean, I got briefed by your agency because I was still in Congress when this thing kicked off, and it was 3 days. 3 days, this will be over, maybe 2 weeks, and then we're going to implement an insurgency thing, and we'll, you know, we'll get weapons in there. Maybe in 10 years, we'll bleed the Russians dry. Instead, the Ukrainians have fought amazingly heroically, incredibly heroically against all odds. And I look at that and I'm like, the fact that we would even be doing anything but fully supporting Ukraine until they made the decision that it's time to stop the war is beyond me, why we would do that. But I'm so proud of them. I am so unproud of our country. And as John and I have talked about a number of times offline, Europe really has to pick up the slack here and step up and recognize that the future of their continent is based on this. So, yeah, I would say generally, I find myself very embarrassed of America's foreign policy at this moment, and very embarrassed of having been a Republican that used to believe that actually Russia was bad, and that we used to believe that. Because now I recognize it was all based on, I don't know, some way to own the libs, I guess.
Having lived in Russia and worked on Russia for years, those of us who have done it have been surprised, not just by this administration or even the Biden administration, but subsequent administrations. Every time they seem to come in and they think, if we're just nicer to Russia, or if we just try to bring them into the fold, you know, it'll be better. The Russians aren't looking for friends. You need to punch them in the nose. And it isn't like a new thing we've learned. This is like consistent. They've screwed us consistently. They're at war with us, political war with us, and they move on. So just to add some other things.
Yeah.
What other national security issues are you paying attention to? There's Venezuela. There's this new national security strategy. What are the things that concern you on the national security front?
Yeah, it's a couple things. So the Venezuela thing, look, I personally, and I may be wrong here, but I don't think Donald Trump's going to attack Venezuela because honestly, and this may be a good thing in the long run, he's kind of a coward. Like he really is. Even when he struck Iran, which I thought was the right thing to do, you know, at the time, given all the circumstances, he bombed and then immediately was like, time out. It's over, right? Instead of doing what every military person knows, which is, okay, now take a look at how much damage you did and make a decision if you need to strike again or not, okay? Now, regardless, Venezuela, I don't know. I don't think he's going to, they may try to take out Maduro or something. It's not going to be a massive invasion. I am very bothered by the killing of drug boats in the Caribbean. Because to me, look, I flew, you know, for the National Guard. So overseas, I did special ops stuff. So, you know, we were signals intelligence in the plane. Stateside, we do counter drug. We also did border. And we did interdiction on the seas. You know, we weren't great at interdiction on the seas because we just had the camera. We didn't have the signals. But we did some of that. And what was so effective on the seas was you find something, you know, the guys would shoot the engine out of it. And then you interdict it and you get intelligence. I worked with a lot of your targets in Iraq. And I just put this out the other day. I was thinking of it. It's like 8 out of 10 of the targets that I would go after as part of Task Force 16 or 17, 8 out of 10 were, the goal was to capture them, right? Now, if they were too dangerous, they'd be a kill. Or if they were unwilling to go, they'd be a kill. But the goal was to capture. Because you capture, you get their cell phone, you see everybody they've called a bunch, right? And you exploit that information. Same thing with drugs. If we're serious about this, And by the way, Venezuela is not the narco state that we should be concerned about, right? It's other states. But you would capture them. This is, and the other thing is, I'm going too long, but this damages our moral authority. This isn't about the two guys hanging off the boat, whether they were good guys or bad guys, right? I don't know. Let's assume they were the worst two guys to ever live in human history, okay? But they were in a mode where they were trying to survive. Do not tell me they were trying to flip a boat. I mean, what were they in a canoe? If they were in a canoe, how are there 11 people in a canoe? And how can a Hellfire missile, how would you need three more Hellfire missiles? Okay? Don't tell me they're trying to flip it. But regardless of whether they were good or bad, we have a law of armed conflict that dictates that they are not legitimate targets at that moment. We have maritime law. We have rescued pirates from the sea, for God's sakes. We rescued Nazis from the sea. We executed Nazis that didn't rescue Americans from the sea. This is not about these two drug guys. This is about our soul. This is about America's soul, the damage we're doing to ourselves. And the people pulling the trigger, I mean, probably the people that pulled the trigger is some 25-year-old kid that is gung-ho about serving his country, that in 20 years is going to be sitting around going through his head and at 100% PTSD with the VA because he realizes he pulled the trigger on two people that were struggling in the water to survive.
And for our own people, we have our own soldiers that, you know, if we say it's okay to kill people who are surrendering.
Yes. What message are you sending? What about the young kids, by the way, the 18-year-olds right now that are thinking about joining the military that have seen no leader, really, to both parties' shame, no leader stand up and really inspire people about America and how we, you know, are a country that strives for goodness and better. And we're not just competing for power in the world with Russia and China. Like, yes, we have to do it if it's in America's interest, but we bring with us some moral focus. So I'll say all that to say, lastly, my big concern is China. And it's not so much that China's going to invade Taiwan. I do have worry about that. But it's that this administration is selling everything to China right now, including the advanced chips, because China knows smartly that if they can give Donald Trump and his family money, he'll give them anything he wants. That's a long answer. I'm sorry. But
yeah, that reminds me of Lenin's famous quote that the capitalists will sell us the rope with which we hang them.
Totally. And that's what you see. And Russia, I mean, I guess I skipped over Russia generally, I assumed with Ukraine, but I will say Russia is an existential threat as well. They're not a superpower. They are a great power. But the question is, you know, whatever this war ends in, does Vladimir Putin make the decision to rearm and attack? Look, if I'm him and I truly believe the United States won't defend Europe, I may see how far I can get.
One of our colleagues characterized Russia as Upper Volta with missiles.
Yeah, perfect. That's perfect.
I don't think Upper Volta still exists, does it?
No, I don't think so either.
I'm glad I'm not Russian. I know that much.
Well, let me get you out of here with this. And I feel bad. I really appreciate you coming on, even though you have a bit of a cold.
No, it's great. I enjoyed it.
So just one quick, if you were advising someone who is running, a new member of Congress or a new national security official who's coming in, either now or in the next few years, what would you advise them based on your experience to prepare for the pressure to prioritize the country over party? Any practical things?
Yeah, I think the first thing is, like, in assuming my job is not to convince you to do it, you've already decided, it is that you will, whether it's in the agency, whether it's in Congress, whether it's in DOD, whatever, you will likely in your life have to face a moral dilemma. And you don't know what that's going to look like, right? I never would have imagined January 6th, right? It was so unthinkable. But I also knew that I would reach a moral dilemma. And I think there is some real importance, just like, you know, a police officer sitting watching TV, you know, dry firing his gun, pulling it, right, to practice that muscle memory. And then you see a cop, like, having a police shooting, and you see in a quarter of a second they have their gun out, right, and they've saved themselves. But that is muscle memory. It is the same thing in courage, which is you don't know what that decision is, but there will come a day when you have to make a decision that will be, everything in you will be screaming against you making that decision because your body, your biology wants to defend itself. And standing alone is the, and outside of a tribe, by the way, which is like our most basic instinct, that is a survival instinct. But the more you in your head just say, like, if there's a point in which I have to make, you know, a defining decision, I will do it. Now, that doesn't mean run around and look for ways to be a contrarian, right? Yeah. You know, it's like it's the military, you don't have to look around and find everything you disagree with. But if there's that moment, be willing to make it. And that's what I would say is like that dry fire in your mind about, you know, if there's that point.
Danny, well, Adam, thank you so much for spending time with us. And if there's anything, are there anything you're plugging now, shows other than your Amazon show or books or anything that we can aim people towards?
I've actually got a children's book coming out. Ooh, that'll be out, though, in the spring. I'll tell you what it's called, although it's called That's What Heroes Do. It's really good. And I say that because it's my book. So, and then, I'm on Substack, so, you know, there. And other than that, John, I think I get to see you in a month or two.
Yeah.
In the cold area, so we'll catch you
there.
We'll
get some warm drinks in us.
That's right.
I'd like to add my thanks, Adam. I mean, really, you've got the moral courage that I so greatly respect. And I have at least some optimism that hopefully the Republican Party will regain its soul at some point.
Me too. And can I just say, and I appreciate you saying that about the courage, but, and I mean this, this isn't like self-deprecating, like falsely, it's not really courage. It's just, and I've said this before, but like I was surrounded by cowards because you all took an oath. You understand when that defining thing comes up, what your oath requires. They all knew it, but they were all scared. All I did was what my oath said. That's it.
We had a senior CIA officer who ran the clandestine service who said, "Why is it that I have officers who will risk their lives, but not their careers?"
Amen.
So true.
Best thing to say. No, best thing.
So true. So true. Well, yep. I think you did more than that, but I also do think Thanks. That all of us have to do more than we're doing. So again, thank you very much. And let me just close out by saying to people, if you like what you're hearing, please subscribe to the Sentinel and follow Steady State content and give us a 5-star review on Google if you can. The reviews really help us get important content to the widest audience possible. So stay informed, stay engaged. And join us next Tuesday for another episode of Steady State Sentinel. This is John Cypher and Jim Lawler, still standing watch.
Thank you for listening to the Steady State Sentinel podcast. Don't miss out on more insights and exposés from America's premier global security experts.
Also, subscribe to our Substack at substack.com/@steadystate1 and follow our social media. And join us right here next week for another exciting edition.
The Steady State is a nonprofit organization working to sustain our democracy and national security.
Join us and support our mission by visiting www.thesteadystate.org.